Welcome to Failing Up. We don't have a theme song.
Well, we might not have a theme song, Eden, but we do have a theme, and that is failure.
And we talk to people about their failures and mistakes and how they grew from it.
Simple as that. Listen up. Thank you for listening to another episode of Failing Up, Eden. Thank you for having me here in your lovely studio, your podcast studio.
Thanks.
Another lovely day here in Southern California, too.
I think you're going to make listeners really jealous. It seems like every podcast, we're like, it's so lovely today.
It is, though. And you have this amazing view of a LA landmark.
Butt. Yeah, so great.
Of a landmark in LA.
Exactly.
Seriously. And so it is a really lovely...
Beyonce's butt. That's a landmark. It should be a landmark.
As a person who grew up in New Jersey, this is something that's special for me. Okay, I'm sorry. And you know what? Our guest, actually, I believe he was definitely born in New Jersey, right? But did he grow up in New Jersey is the question that's going to come up.
And I don't want to spoil it, so I'll wait for you to ask.
Do you want to introduce?
Sure. No, you can do it. Because I mess it up with the applause. So you can do it.
Okay. David Iserson. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Or is that it? Is. Okay. David Iserson. That sounds right to me.
Okay. From Freehold, New Jersey.
Yes.
I grew up in Lakewood.
I lived in Lakewood till I was 13.
Did you really?
Oh,
yes.
Wow. How do you not know each other?
That's a good question. I'm going to guess you're a Jew.
It's a town of Hasidic Jews. Right. I was not a Hasidic Jew.
I was not a Hasidic Jew either, but I did live in Lakewood. But I went to the Hasidic school. I went to Lakewood Hebrew Day School growing up.
Oh, goodness.
Most of the time.
All right.
And then middle school, high school, I went to the Lakewood public school system. But you were probably already then in Freehold at that point.
Yeah, I was in Freehold from eighth grade on.
Okay.
But I was born in Freehold, lived in Lakewood. By the lake. I lived by the lake.
By Lake Carisalgo.
Lake Carisalgo, which I guess... And the story that I grew up with... This is so interesting.
This is inside baseball, inside New Jersey.
Well, there was a story, just the probable stories. It was just the beginning of the developer's kid's name.
Correct.
But then I also heard that three girls died.
Right.
three girls died in Lake Carisalgio.
Has there been a horror movie about this?
Kara, Sally, and Joanna or whatever, died in that lake.
That was the old rumor. Yeah. You're 100% right, but the truth was it was like the developers, whoever made the actual lake, because it's a man-made lake, it was his daughters, Kara, Sal, and Joe, Sally and Joe. So Carisalgio. That's very funny. So yeah, we actually grew up very, very close to each other. It's pretty crazy.
How did you not run into each other?
I mean,
we may have run into each other.
Might have, but you know, we all look alike, so it's hard to tell each other apart.
But it's like when I meet someone that's from LA and roughly the same age, it's like, what school did you go to? How did I not see you?
Yeah.
It's like, what's a big city?
Listen, one of my closest friends in the world, I went to Rutgers. He's a fraternity brother of mine. He grew up in the next town over from me, Howell.
Mm-hmm.
Never met him my entire life until we went to college together. So it happens. You know.
Yeah.
It's not the same as LA.
Yeah.
Because nobody sees you in a commercial. That's why.
Okay.
It's never like, oh.
That's how it works. Got it.
Anyway, sorry.
So you grew up in New Jersey.
Yes.
I grew up in New Jersey.
And did you always want to be a writer? Did little David have other inspirations?
I don't know that I knew that writer was a job for a long time.
I certainly didn't as a kid.
still not positive.
Probably not a job. I'm still not sure it's a job yet.
Sometimes just feels like a con.
Multi-level marketing scheme.
I both write screenplays and I belong to this pyramid scheme that sells leggings. my sister was sort of involved in that pyramid scheme for a while, and she's like, listen, I know that they're scamming me, but they're really good leggings.
Worth it.
Yeah, so I wanted to be a cartoonist. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have like a comic strip, like a Calvin and Hobbes Boom County style comic strip. I wanted to be an actor, so did like local community theater, and then I went to like an arts summer camp. And
you went to you went to summer camp with two of my friends. You went to summer camp with Mike Kaplan, right?
Yes.
Oh.
And Zoe Levy.
Yes.
Yeah. See, and I had a birthday party, and I invited like my friends. And they all knew each other before. Oh, and Nick Malice, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And they all knew each other. I'm like, how do you guys all know each other? I don't even have to introduce you. Like, we all went to this weird artsy summer camp.
Where was this summer camp located?
So this was in New Milford, Connecticut. It was called Bucks Rock. Yeah. So I was in a Like the bunks were sort of broken up, a little like dorms. So I was on a floor with Mike Kaplan, with Nick Malice at different points. So we were not room together.
Everybody from that camp became a writer.
What
I think.
Was that success camp? Like what
success? I know I didn't go to that camp. Fuck.
How do you get to? And then Nick Malice, for example, is he from California?
No, he's from New York.
Oh, he is. Okay, because I'm just trying to figure out how everybody like ends up.
They're all from New York.
At the Connecticut. From New York. But still, it's Connecticut.
It's Connecticut.
Was it the only thing, kind of like the well-known? Like this is where you go if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was more like very specific theater camps, and mm-hmm. and then but this had an amalgam of visual arts and performing arts. So they didn't dictate what you had to do. You just had to do something. So that was the sort of socialist grand sort of Montessori idea of the camp, that they have all these little shops set up with glass blowing and plays and jewelry making and painting and batik and nice. And soldering or whatever. And then you just had to do something. You had to do something during the day. So I liked both
soldering, of course,
both and soldering and performing, and so I did lots of visual art stuff, but I did a lot of plays, and then I did a lot of comedy, and then when I eventually grew out of my parents wanting to pay for me to go to that camp, you know, then you become a CIT, a counselor in training, a junior counselor, and I think they paid me $250 a summer, but then I got to go,
right.
and then I started writing stuff. I would write, worked in. We called it clowning, but it was sketch comedy and improv, and I would write sketches, and then I was like, oh, this is more appealing and more control than going out and performing, because I liked performing, I liked being on stage, but I never thought I was great at it. So writing felt like a synthesis of all the things that I liked.
So camp actually, what that was the moment where you were like, oh my god, I can make a living out of this? Were you?
Well, no,
you
I mean, I don't know if I can make a living.
Like,
out of
I
it,
want
but,
to
but
be
I,
a writer.
I want to do that. And then when I went to college, I still wasn't totally sure if I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a writer. So I was like, I'll major in theater and I'll major in film. And in orientation week, the dean of the School of Communication said that you can't do both. So I had to choose. Now, it turned out that like plenty of people did do both. I mean, I didn't realize that you just had to ask twice. But
the conversion to Judaism, I got out three times.
Yes.
Serious.
But when somebody says I can't, you know, when an authority figure says no,
okay,
it's
bye.
Like,
yeah.
Sure, I just want you to like me.
Right.
Yeah. So I just kind of took an assessment of where I wanted to be. And then I veered into the film program, the writing program, and that's and here I am. Okay. .. Here I am.
Well, it was that easy,
skipped,
huh?
You skipped so much. So wait, back up. you couldn't have just gone from like what made you be like, okay, I can do this professionally. I can make money off this. What gave you that confidence? Or like, for me, I think someone who I really respected, who I really admired, told me I'm funny, and I didn't think would. You didn't need to bullshit me. Like, I'm not important. Like, you don't need to make me happy. So that gave me the confidence to like try. Did anything like that ever happen, or do you think I can just do it?
I think that there were. I've had like some good teachers in my life, and definitely people who, like, I remember English teachers in high school saying that mm-hmm. that might be something I could do. But I'm not confident about a lot of things, I wouldn't quite say that it was confidence, but it was an idea that it was something that I liked the stuff that I was doing. And I think if I had intellectualized it enough to think about if I could actually, how I would compete in the world amongst other people doing it, I think that would be very discouraging. But the people that I knew both at summer camp and various points in my life were like some of the funniest, most creative people I had met up to that point, and still are also probably amongst the funniest, most talented people I know. And I felt like I can hold my own amongst those people. Now, I assumed that, you know, moving out to Los Angeles was just going to be a giant just sort of pit of super talented people, but it's not quite that.
it's a little saturated.
It's a little, yeah. It's I had I mean, I had an internship in college and I read a lot of scripts, and I think that took apart a lot of the mysticism that the streets are teeming with just incredibly talented people waiting to get discovered, when you actually find out that, okay, most things are bad, and people are so desperate for good material that there is a place for you if you are at least as good as you think maybe you could be.
Yeah, I think that certainly intimidated me for a very long time, but I think intimidates other people when they come out to LA and they see everyone at a coffee shop writing on their screenplay. You just look at everyone's laptop and it's like Final Draft. And you're like, oh my God, are all these people working? Are all these people getting jobs and I'm not? And it's like, no, everyone's trying. They're not necessarily good at it.
Right, yeah.
You know, but everyone tries, which I guess is the difference between a Starbucks in LA versus a Starbucks in Nebraska.
People try or act as if they will try.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the difference between people who, I'm using writing as an example, people who call themselves writers and people who actually finish the thing they're working on is there is a big sort of chasm in the middle there of people who actually finish something.
Right.
So I think if you can get that far, that also kind of puts you ahead of a lot of people.
So what made you want to move out to LA?
I moved out of LA like 2 days after graduation.
Really?
What year is that?
2000.
Okay.
I went back to my parents' house in New Jersey, and I was like, time is wasting.
Yeah.
there's a whole world out there.
Oh my God.
So you were on top of it. I think I was nervous I was going to miss some opportunity or something like that.
I didn't know what the hell I was doing when I finished college.
Right. You said you were here, so you didn't have to get into a car.
I'm from here, but that's the thing, is to my detriment. I think because I was here, it didn't push me enough to try harder when I was younger. But you were going for it.
I was going for it. I
And obviously you didn't come out here with a job. You just planned to have a job.
I didn't come out here with a job. I had friends from college that were also coming out here. I had two friends from college who came here before me, before I got here, because I drove from New Jersey to Los Angeles.
It's an adventure. So, which way did you go? Did you go the 80 way or the 76?
I went the southern route. I saw parts of the country I'd never seen before. So
never want to see again.
Well, I'd also driven out here from Chicago when I was in college. So I drove to LA by myself, mm-hmm. and then drove back, and then drove with a friend when I moved out here. But yeah, slowly, like 6 days, which I guess is not that slow, mm-hmm. but it felt slow. Like we were done by sundown and exploring whatever city we were in. And mm-hmm. then I got here and I had an apartment waiting for me in beautiful Sherman Oaks. And that was it.
How quick do you find a job?
I found a job within 4 weeks.
Writing job.
What's that?
A writing job.
Oh, no, God, no. Oh. No. No, I didn't have a script in shape. I didn't have anyone who was really looking for what I had to write, and I wasn't super happy with what I had written. So I was going out here to, you know, to try to do something vaguely in the entertainment industry. So I got a job as a receptionist, mm-hmm. for a film producer who had a deal at Miramax. Which, you know, which
wasn't bad then. Well,
no, it was that then too.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It was run by a monster who was not in prison.
Right.
but yeah, so I had that job. So I sat at the front desk, I read scripts. I was the assistant to the director of development there, and I stayed at that job for a little over a year. I read a ton of scripts a week, and I
were they good scripts?
Four or five of them were.
Oh, really? Yeah, I always wonder, like, when people read a lot of scripts, if, like, I don't know if it's helpful. I think I've gotten to the point where when I read a bad script, it makes me a worse writer.
It was helpful at the time. It was helpful because then when I...
Because
eventually I quit that job because I was like, I moved out here to be a writer and I have not had time to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to do something. And then when I sat down to write my first script after I had had that job for a year, and I couldn't even think about writing. Like on the weekends, I was so tired. So I sat down and wrote a script for for the person who had my job at a different company. Like I, like the person who read my script, I was writing to entertain that person. Mm. I was taking the approach of I'm trying to make your weekend read a little bit easier, and I was trying to write towards not falling into the same sort of boring traps that I found that I read. And so I think that made it, that gave me a sort of framework to write around.
Yeah.
And like your first, the first stuff that you wrote, are you proud of that? Or do you look back on it and go, that was crap?
Stuff I wrote in college, some of it I think is crap. But the script that I wrote after I had that development job for like a year, I still love that script. And that's what got me a lot of jobs that I still get to this day. It got me my representation. It's a script I love that I would love to have made one day. I think
it's weird that some scripts I hear from writers that get them jobs and get them representation and they're so good and everyone loves them never get made.
Sad,
you make these things.
Yes, from your lips to God's ears. But I think the what gets a thing made, I'll never really, yeah. I never understand it. It never makes sense to me. But to me, it makes sense. I like it. It is a synthesis of all the things that I'm interested in. And I think that when you're young and not super experienced, that you can sort of tap into something interesting and good and special, and you know, do things that you spend the rest of your career trying to sort of duplicate. But I think the difference is like experience means that you can try to tap into that more often.
Right.
I think that, you know, that script I just sort of kind of wrote in like a weird hypnotic daze that I'm not sure that I can
access.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could do every time, you know.
Right.
I sort of like purged it, vomited it all out. Like it was just sort of like bubbling up inside my brain for so long, and then I was just able to like unleash it. But I don't exactly know how, and I don't know exactly if it was like there were any teachable moments in it, and it was something I was able to duplicate again, because then like the script I wrote after that was awful.
What happened in the script you wrote after that?
I mean, I
this was a podcast about failure, so we're going to ask about it.
I had an idea. I am somebody who does not let go of ideas very often. Like if I like something, I will try to revisit it, and I will try to sort of reshape it into something. And there are things that I've written into different forms a million times. So the script I wrote after the script that I really loved had an idea that I really loved. It just was not executed well. There are themes that I come back to over and over again, or ideas, and that was a time travel script, which I've written more time travel scripts since then. So that was an idea I kind of turned into something else and tried to write as a pilot like 12 years later, which also didn't get made, but I liked a lot more the second time around.
Right.
So I took a second shot at it.
Yeah.
Do you think failure is important when it comes to being a writer? Like we had a guest on 2 weeks ago, Duplass? Is that the right
Duplass.
Way? I can't.
Oh, you should have found out how to pronounce his name.
I pronounce it.
Yeah, I didn't do that. That's why I only called him Jay. But regardless, I mean, essentially he said, you know, keep going. If you're not selling your script, just keep writing, keep writing, keep writing. In my mind, I'm like, I feel like there are some people who are like, there's a natural thing where like, yes, keep writing. It will make you better as a writer.
It
but
will.
Like, aren't there are some people who are just should not be writing at all, like stop writing. Isn't that some advice we should give people?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, God bless you if you want to give them that advice. Like, you know, some people don't want to hear it, and that's, yeah, I mean, there are people who shouldn't be writing. I don't know if it is for me to say that, to tell them.
I think I'm an okay writer, but if I keep writing and keep writing, am I eventually going to sell something in your mind, or no, not necessarily?
Well, I mean, let's unpack a little bit what failing at writing a script is.
Yeah.
And
means your baby's ugly.
Well, no, if it means that nobody wants to make it, mm-hmm. I don't think that's a failure of a script.
A lot of horrible things get made.
There's the luck to it. The thing you can't control is whether anything is going to eventually happen with it beyond you churning out something that you like from your computer. And if you can do that, then if you can if you can write something that you're proud of, that you like, I don't think that that's failure. I think that there is going to be some value in it, even if it is not the value that you wanted it to have when you began. If you had some sort of grand idea that this is going to be a movie and people are going to love this movie and this is going to be the thing that changes your life, and if it doesn't become that, I don't think that that's a failure. But if it's something that you're not proud of, if it's something that you felt that you've compromised on, that you've not done a great job on, yeah, that is a failure.
But don't you need people to love your baby in the sense that, like, if you wrote your first, you know, the first script that really worked, right? And you thought it was amazing, right? It is as good as it is, the same exact thing, but other people did not give that sort of positive feedback. Like, you need other people to make your baby beautiful, as opposed, like, you of course you're gonna think it's pretty, but until they tell you it's pretty, it's not pretty.
I don't know. I mean, I think
most writers are very harsh critics of themselves.
I think I reject the notion that I'm the one who likes it, even if nobody else does. I think we're all writers, for the most part, at least ones that I understand and relate to, are pretty hard on themselves and pretty thin-skinned. Mm-hmm. So if I write something that I'm really proud of, then I do think that that is a version of success. Now, do I want other people to like it too? Absolutely want other people to like it too. There's just one point in what screenwriters and television writers do where at a certain point your script goes off into a secret room that you don't have access to, and somebody decides that they are going to, whether they're going to pay you for this, whether they're not going to pay you for this, whether they're going to make it, whether they're not going to make it. And that is a thing that, regardless if it is something that you're proud of, regardless if it's something that people loved and told you that they loved, that is a thing that is sort of beyond your control. And if you sort of pin your feelings of success and failure on that, then that, I think that's just going to it's just going to paralyze you.
Yeah,
that's fair.
But yeah, I mean, you want, write something you're proud of and share it with people whose opinions you respect. And if they say, I don't get it, it's not good, take that seriously. Maybe then they're right. I'm just sort of talking about the sort of end point of a thing that you've written. That's not always going to be what you intended it to be. If it's more likely than not going to be nothing, even if it's, you know, a beautiful thing that only exists in your hard drive.
Right.
I think calling that a failure is probably just like a debilitating thing for you to do as a creative person.
Okay. I think that's fair. Let me ask you this. So then 2003, you ended up writing for Saturday Night Live. Is that right?
That is, yeah. I had
you submitted a packet, I assume.
I'd submitted Weekend Update jokes the previous season.
Okay.
That I got a few of those on the air, and off of that, I'd submitted a packet, but also off of the Weekend Update jokes that I had gotten on Weekend Update, then I got hired off of that.
So is it a traditional audition with Lorne and all that stuff? Like, are you going? I mean, from what I can tell, from what I've heard anyway, it's like, there is no line between actor writer on Saturday Night Live when you're auditioning, or am I?
Oh, off? No, I did not audition as a performer. Okay. Yeah, no, there is a lot of times a performer will audition and then they will get hired as a writer. Mm-hmm. But I just went in
pure
as a writer.
So you don't have to do a monologue or pretend.
I did a monologue in my own brain. But no, I didn't meet Lorne before I got hired. Also,
was that like your? Did you consider that like your big break, or
that was my first? Yeah, that was my first paid writing. My first payment I ever got as a writer was
wow.
A joke I got on Weekend Update.
That's awesome.
That I got a $100 check in the mail from Tina Fey.
Huh.
When I was just in my, you know, little apartment in Los Feliz.
That's, and did you watch it? I assume they used it, obviously, if you got paid for it or not.
I did watch it. I you know, you don't really know what's going to happen until it's on TV.
That's
but
those
I
Weekend Updates.
But I got a heads up that it was going to be on.
That's awesome.
So I did watch it.
I'm holding my phone because I want to mention, this is the cast of 2003, 2004, by the way.
Okay.
Rachel Dratch, Tina Fey, Jimmy Fallon, Will Forte, Daryl Hammond, Seth Meyers, Amy Poehler, and Chris Parnell. Like, are you fucking kidding me with that?
You skipped some people.
Who did I skip?
You skipped some people who you might want on your failure podcast. That's a good group. No, it was many feelings all at once. I mean, it was exhilarating. It was terrifying. It was a job that I don't know if I was like dreaming about it at that point in my life, but SNL meant so much to me growing up. And yeah, I mean, I was super young and very green, and you're just kind of thrown in there, and it's the kind of job that makes a lot of sense as your first job. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how I would handle it if I work there now, which I mean, I know what it would be like to work there now because it's a nightmare I have a lot.
You have to move back to New York for that, I assume?
I moved to New York for that.
Okay, and so what would be the biggest nightmare of? Is it just
No. It's just the pressure of it. You know, I think that I know who I am as a writer at this point in my life, but I don't think I was great at SNL. I think that there were things that I was good at and things that I wasn't. And I wasn't great at the politics of it. And I also just, it didn't quite fit with my own sort of process. Like, SNL is written really late at night, like, you know, at least in the era that I was there. And I think it has changed since then. But, you know, people don't really start writing until midnight on the night before the table read on Tuesday night, and you know, and they're writing till 10 a.m. And I'm sort of in my life now, I'm pretty much out of steam at 6 p.m. And so it just didn't quite fit in with like how my brain works, and also, yeah, I mean, it's really long work weeks, and I mean it's also, you know, also every 3 weeks you get like a week off, which is lovely, you know, but then it was, you know, I just took that week and I just slept right through it. But it was cool. I mean, it was cool. There were cool people there. Every week a different famous person comes in, and there was like, they had budgets for parties that I don't think they have at SNL anymore. I mean, there were parties and parties and parties after every show,
yeah,
and meals that were so extravagant. And I'm there. I'm like 24 years old and like my first week, and you know, we're ordering dinner from like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and like some much older, more experienced SNL writer, and it's like, you know, this is the most important lesson that you're going to learn at Saturday Night Live: order the steak and the lobster, because you don't know what's going to be better when it gets here. Give the other one to the intern.
Oh my god!
It's like, what is happening here?
That's crazy. That's amazing. And then so, what happens at the end of the 2004 season is that they just don't renew your contract, or
yeah, they said you know you're too good. No, they didn't. They didn't. They did not renew my contract, and they did not renew a lot of people's contracts over you know, several, like almost every new person in my sort of class didn't come back either that season or the next season. So it was a real bummer, but
were you a little relieved that I get your sleep back and all that stuff?
I mean, the sleep less so. I mean, I wasn't. I think with jobs in general and that job in particular, I think the way it ended, and I think it's probably true with relationships too, I think the way it ended, I think, recast the whole experience, and it made me sort of reevaluate a lot of things that I felt were positive into negatives, because ultimately my contract wasn't renewed, and so it felt like the negatives outweighed the positives to the other people who were in the, you know, in the room that,
well, like
in
relationships.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what did this mean to you?
Yeah, it's like it's like everything seemed to be moving along. Like I left the season fairly confident enough that, you know, I tried to contribute something to all the episodes I was in, but so then I was just, you know, then I had to spend the next period of time wondering, oh, was this is this why? Is this why? Is this why? And, you know, these are things you don't get closure on. You just have to move on.
Yeah. So how did you move on?
Well, I had to literally move because...
Go back to LA?
Yeah. It made no sense to stay in New York because...
So expensive.
So expensive. It's much, you know, for all the shit that LA gets... it's
comfortable shit.
It's way more pleasant to be unemployed in LA than
that's
in New York.
True. I tell people this, like when they wonder, hey, why didn't you move out? Like, cause I did live in New York for like a year, and it's like, cause it's so much more pleasant to even do nothing. To be bummed in LA yes. is like fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, it's at different points in your this is a slight tangent, but I always think like at different points in your life, like. A certain amount of money feels like a lot of money. And I remember when I was in New York one summer in college. And at that point, like $20 was so enormously hard to get my hands on. And so important not to lose. It felt like every time I left my apartment, I had to spend $20 on something.
I
feel like that's what New York is.
Yeah.
New York is perpetually that you just can't go anywhere without losing whatever the equivalent of $20 is to you at every moment.
So true.
That's really funny.
Yeah. Like I got a Coke in New York and it was like $12.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Exactly. Yeah.
Well, come on.
We were just talking about cigarettes. The price of cigarettes is all that.
Yeah. So you moved back to LA. Did you immediately have a job lined up?
So I moved back to LA. I didn't, and then I wanted to do features. And so I came out, I pitched some movies. I got some movie jobs. I spent 3 or 4 years employed, but writing movies that didn't get made. Mm-hmm. That's a perfectly good life, but it is a weird thing. You have this invisible job. Like it's hard enough to explain what you do to your mom, even when you've written things that are on TV. It's much harder to explain what you do to your mom when, like, you know, it's not anything. It's you get a check for a thing that disappears. So
if you even get a check,
is there more satisfaction when you actually sell something that gets made?
Oh, absolutely.
But to me, I'm like, that doesn't necessarily mean that was better, though, right? I mean, it just means that that's what that person, that somebody picked up as they enjoyed.
It's not the act of getting made exactly. It's that every time when you have very little to show for it after you've spent a year on something, it does feel like when that job ends, you're starting all over again from the beginning. It's very hard to get traction. It feels like you're just in the same exact place on the treadmill. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, you know, you do the best job you can do. You do in a way that maybe people are happy or happy enough, and different reasons that, you know, you know the movie got made, but they didn't use your script and so you didn't get credit, or you were adapting a book and then the rights lapse. Like there's a million things that are not even tied to you, but then once that job is done, you just have to go back into the pit of other people trying to find the same jobs, and you are not the person who did blank, so it's still harder to distinguish yourself.
Right. That makes sense.
How does it feel? Like, did you ever, I feel like this a lot, but did you ever feel like, oh, maybe I can't keep on writing because this isn't getting made or something? Like, should I maybe do something else? Like, did that ever occur to you to even, like...
It did not occur to me to just quit because I still had, you know, I had plenty of ideas and things I was interested in doing, and I felt like I was still just like dancing right at the edge of where I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. But I zagged in different ways. So after that sort of, you know, period of writing movies that didn't get made, I went into TV, and after I went back into TV and after a period of, you know, wanting to have ownership over something, I wrote a novel. So like I tried to do things to answer the problems that I was feeling and the things that I was feeling unsatisfied in. But it sort of got to a point in my life where writing was the only thing that I was very sure that I knew exactly how to do. So I wasn't really entertaining the idea of doing something else because I don't know what that would be at this point.
Yeah.
And do you have a preference for, and I don't know if this is a dumb question because I'm not a writer, but do you have a preference for?
There are no dumb questions. TV or movies?
Or even writing a novel. Like, is there one that you're like, oh, I'm so much more into?
I am more into, I mean, I'm sure we'll cover this as our conversation goes on, but like I worked on a lot of TV staffs and I think that, you know, different shows are more fun than other shows, and it's really, really great to be around a lot of people and collaborate. But at a certain point, it's just not yours. They're not your characters. They're not your voices. So it's hard to write the thing that you write at like the top of your ability in that way. So I have no real preference between movies, TV, or books. I really just have a preference of like ownership and characters, and I like to write things that burst out of me.
Okay. And also, how about certain TV shows? Is it more fun to write for Mad Men than for, I don't know, whatever? Like, is there
oh, sure. Yeah, there are shows that just like, oh, this makes much more sense for me than, and you know, there's shows that have been not a perfect fit, and you don't really always know that until you're kind of in it.
Yeah.
And sometimes until you're in the middle of writing your script that like, oh, this is not exactly my voice. But I think as I've worked more, I do have some sense, like when I read a pilot or watch an episode of a show, that okay, I can write this. Mm-hmm. And also sometimes that I know that I can't, which is as helpful.
Yeah, I think knowing that.
Can you turn down a writing job and say, this is just not my vote, not the kind of voice that I put out, kind of thing? Or
I have turned down a job that I knew that I wouldn't be good at. Huh. A job like on a staff of a TV show. Like sometimes when it is the point in, you know, the year when everyone is hiring, at least in network television, you go around to like
general meetings.
Yeah, you go around meetings with showrunners, and then you may get an offer on a show, and then, you know, there's definitely a time that I got an offer on a show that I was pretty sure I would be shitty at, so I turned it down.
Why would you be bad at Conan? I'm just kidding. I just made up a thing. So it literally was, is it the voice of the show or is it the person who is actually speaking? So like, obviously it wasn't Conan, but if it was, would it be because of Conan or because of the type of...
We should probably not use Conan as an example because late night TV is not, it wasn't that sort of thing. It's a sitcom.
Like I always tell people, I can never write on Game of Thrones. If they offered me a job, I would not take it because I don't know how to write that. And I'd disappoint so many people. I'd get fired the first week and the show would be bad. And all these fans are going to be like, why is Game of Thrones bad all of a sudden?
Yeah. Well, I've looked at the IMDb page and I think I figured it out.
Exactly. Like, I know I cannot write that kind of show. It's not my style of I like watching it. It's not my style of writing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, particularly with a comedy, you know, sometimes just... there is a type of joke, a structure of joke, a structure of character, a type of situation that's in the show that you're like, oh, these are not stories that I feel close to. This is not a tone that I feel speaks to me. And it's just, you know, it just doesn't feel like a match for me. And I think it's a thing. It's a pitfall a lot of younger writers have where, and they should want to take any job that's offered to them. But, you know, if you do have to know what you're going to excel at and what you're not going to excel at.
Yeah.
And it's going to ultimately make you more successful in your career if you can have some awareness of that.
That's some sage advice. Do you have any other, what other advice would you give to a young writer?
Don't chase what you think the marketplace wants. You know, I think that when I started out, and I'm sure this is still the same case, like, you know, you would sit down with somebody, like a agent or something like that. And you're like, this is what people are buying now. So try to write something like this. But if you're really just trying to chase something that isn't coming from a place where it is like an idea that excites you and inspires you, then you're probably not going to produce something great. And I think that a lot of people get thrown by comparing themselves to other people. And I think it's hard not to sometimes, but I think that if you can just try to kind of squash that voice in your head that says, well, I'll never be as good as this person, or I'm perpetually jealous as this person. Just the idea of just trying to, it's all versions of the same advice, but just be, have some awareness of what it is that you specifically do so that you are not comparing yourself to other people. You're living in your weird niche.
Yeah. Do you have a mentor?
Do I have a mentor?
I like to say it this way to writers, because okay. I have this problem. It's not really a problem because I have this, but I notice other writers have this problem. Do you have like a person who you think is safe to send work to, who will give you wise advice on it, honest advice, and will not like steal it, or will actually read it, and you trust their opinion, and also you don't feel like you're imposing because they're like, they're super busy because they have their own fame or whatever. Like, I think every writer needs to have some person who's a little bit more successful than them, who's been doing this for a little longer, and who's just like a safe space to share a piece of work that's new and green, and you need to show it to someone because you can't keep editing yourself. You know?
I do have people who I trust.
Okay,
good. I have people who I send things to. And I don't, not necessarily more experienced or more successful, but people who are same success or a little more, a little less. Just, yeah, people I trust. And I think that is absolutely invaluable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's also great advice for new writers, that just like kind of build your little circle of people who.
I think it's so important. And I think it's like, I almost wanted, I was telling someone because they were asking me, like, hey, can you read my script? And I'm like, I'm reading like two people's script right now. I don't even think I'm that good. I'm struggling myself. Like I wish I could advise you to someone else, but it's like, there should be like a big brothers, big sisters for writers, where like you just kind of get matched with someone who could just be your person to just like be safe and trust. I don't know. It's hard to get. But.
Yeah. I think, and I think that being able to have somebody who can, you know, tell you something is good and also tell you something is bad, of course, makes you believe it both ways. I mean, I think that a real pitfall that a lot of creative people fall into is that we see criticism as truth and compliments as politeness. And so we hear criticism so much louder and it becomes very crippling. But I think that, having somebody who gets you innately, that when they say, hey, this is really close, or this is good, or this is something that you should be really excited about, then you can allow yourself to be that excited.
That's good. So what like your latest project's gonna come out soon.
Yes.
That's exciting.
Was it August 3rd?
August 3rd.
I just saw a billboard for it on my way here, but I've seen billboards for it for some reason for a while now.
I think just for this week. I mean, these are the first billboards I've been seeing this week.
And so. We're talking about The Spy Who Dumped Me.
Spy Who Dumped Me, yes.
So what got you to write that?
So kind of perfect for your podcast. I wrote it with my friend Susanna, and we both were kind of licking our wounds after two like big disappointments in our career. She had this movie that she had rewritten and she was directing fall apart. And I had this pilot I was really proud of that died. And we were both like really in a place of really in like low points. And we were working on our own stuff together. We were kind of keeping ourselves honest by like working side by side on our other things and talking it through. And we decided to write something together because we were both at these sort of career low points or at least ebbs. And so we just kind of wanted to write something that people didn't expect from us, something that was really big and fun, and we just sort of like unleashed it in a really, really fast way. And yeah, because I've been in LA for 18 years, and so in no way is this an overnight success, but like this becomes this thing that happened in such a rare way. Like we wrote the thing, you know, from idea to completion in a month, and whoa, then in a, and then in
you're
a
making me feel so lazy.
Well, it's it shouldn't make
I've
you feel
worked
lazy.
Worked on the movie for like a year now,
and we all have. So that's why, like, this thing was just like a weird outlier. Like, it just burst out of us, and then a year we were filming it, and then in a year where it comes out. So it just was this out of nowhere like burst of something.
I remember when you were filming it on Instagram, you were just like, all these great things in Budapest, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, but it was so crazy. Some of the stuff there.
Oh, for sure. It was truly intense and crazy and weird. And like, yeah, when you're writing a movie, when it just exists as like, you know, blank pages and on your computer screen, you know.
Yeah, a PDF.
You can have this conversation with your friend who you're just sitting with and, you know, right, in like a diner and say like, well, where do we want to travel to? All right, well, then we'll write that into the script.
Yeah. I know.
And then it's so weird when it
happens.
When you're there, when you move to Budapest for 4 months.
Wow. That's crazy. Did you learn the language and everything? Or are you like not really good at
Hungarian? I did not. Hungarian is a hard language.
I know. My dad was married to the Hungarian ambassador.
Wow.
I know.
Really?
Before he married my mom. But he was like, and he was so good at languages. He spoke 7 languages, but not Hungarian because it's too hard.
It was a real toughie. I felt like I had gone once as a tourist, like 10 years ago, and I like picked up like a word of Hungarian. I like the woman sitting on the plane next to me on the way to Budapest, she taught me the word for kosanom, for thank you, and I got there and I found it to be just sort of this very cold, unwelcoming city, and so I never got to use that word because no one ever did anything that
really
warranted
that
me
bad,
to thank
huh?
them. But you know, then like 10 years later, the city felt very like new and changed and young and wonderful this time around, and I really had a wonderful time and I truly, truly loved it. But also, the language was impossible, and I didn't
but
learn.
Did you
anything.
Hire locals though?
Yeah, yeah, we hired yeah, locals. Good. We had locals in the crew, but you know, they all speak English. And,
right. Yeah, it's like my uncle worked at the Hilton in Japan for 8 years. Doesn't speak a word of Japanese.
Right.
Because everyone in the hotel speaks English. It's like, not fair.
You know, I adapted my knowledge of Hungarian. So now I don't say kosanom. I say kosi, because that's the place they just say thanks. So right. Kosi. But like everyone like under like 35 speaks English, and everyone above.
Yeah, they watch TV.
Well, they speak English. They learn English in school, and then everyone who grew up in communism
oh, right.
did not learn English. They know Russian.
Oh my gosh.
So there's a real like split in, you know, by age and like in what, you know, and how you relate to different people.
Sorry. So have you seen the movie? Done?
Yeah, 100 times. Yeah.
Oh, 100 times. So. Yeah. How do you feel? Are you happy with it?
I'm really, really happy with it.
So
it
great. I'm so excited.
It turned out like
better than you would think.
Better than I would think, and as I had hoped, and it's
testing well.
It tested well. It tested great.
And now, will you go to like movie theaters and watch people watch your movie?
Yeah, because Jay told us he does that, which I was.
Oh, testing. I'm gonna. Yeah, we're gonna do that.
We're gonna do that on
opening night. Yeah, Susanna, who directed it and I wrote it with. I'm gonna
go to the ArcLight and see it.
We're gonna drive around. We're gonna pop in. We're gonna have our friends go to the ArcLight. Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, Kate McKinnon and Mila Kunis.
Huge names. I mean,
ridiculous.
Huge names.
Ridiculous.
Huge, huge, wonderful, wonderful. The best people.
I mean, that has to be super. Is this like one of the more exciting? Like
This is for sure.
I'm surprised I even got you, honestly, on our podcast. I'm sure you're not going to be on a press tour or something.
Like, the writer that didn't direct the movie is not getting like a ton of press requests.
I don't know. I mean, I remember it actually worked out on an older podcast of mine. We had James Gunn on. The day he got Guardians of the Galaxy, and at the end he goes, oh, thank God you guys didn't ask me about the Marvel movie. And we're like, we don't know what the hell you're talking about.
No.
Yeah, and then Guardians of the Galaxy came out. I think this is going to be we'll see that kind of similar success where we're never going to see David again, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, the completists who are going to go back and listen to this episode years later are like, wow, I can't believe they got him.
Exactly. Any inside scoops on the movie? Funny stories?
I didn't convince whoever's listening that they should really see it.
I mean, I already want to see it, but yeah.
I think that it's, you know, when I was talking before about like trying to write things that feel like they're the things that connect you, that are your voice. Like, I mean, I think there are, what made this such a pleasure is that there are like jokes in this movie that are like exactly the kind of thing that I find funny, which is just wonderful that those things can exist. Mm-hmm. It's secretly sort of subversively like the most Jewish big action comedy, studio release action comedy that imaginable.
That sounds, I love that. Like I saw Eighth Grade last night.
Oh yeah,
I heard that was great.
So good, but there's certain like jokes in it where I'm like, this is so Bo Burnham, and I love that. Like I know that humor, and it's like really refreshing to get jokes that aren't just generic, like, you know, like every other like gross out comedy jokes. Like this is really the writer's voice, so it's fun when like you get to see that in like a movie.
Yeah
especially when you know the person, you know their work, it's really gratifying and interesting to see,
for sure. And yeah, I
is it fun to watch the audience though when they start laughing at your jokes that you wrote? I think that's so
cool. it's incredibly fun. Yeah, and it's like there are different things for, you know, I mean, we haven't like the movie's not out yet, so I've only seen it with like, you know, test audiences, and then like for our friends, right. And so it's interesting to see what different audiences, what kinds of jokes different audiences gravitate to, because they're like, yeah, they're like, you know, there's like weird, very like, you know, sort of inside East Coast kind of jokes about like colleges people attended, sure. And then, you know, and then like, you know, out and out diarrhea jokes and you know, and what different audiences get into it.
And even the Jewy jokes, like,
yeah,
it's like, you know,
who doesn't like diarrhea jokes?
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. So I guess two questions we have for you. The first one would be, what would you consider your biggest failure?
And it could be not just professional.
Just in general.
Oh, gosh. My biggest failure. You know, I who knows? But I mean, what I definitely, what I think about when, where my mind went when I think about it is I went to Northwestern, and I went there specifically because they had this creative writing for media program that you apply to your sophomore year, where you contribute all of like your best writing to it. You know, it's a 10-page application, and they pick people, and then, you know, and then you get sort of specialized, sort of very screenwriting, playwriting, whatever focus classes. And specifically why I went to this school, and I also felt pretty good about who I was a writer at that point. And I put together an application I was very proud of, and I didn't even make the first cut out of not that many people, you know, applying, like just sophomores in the School of Communications at this point. And I was devastated, and I really had to, and it really kind of forced me to sort of reevaluate or to put myself under my own microscope of like, who I think I am, what I think, why am I doing this? What, like, am I deluding myself and to try to come out of the other side and have it sort of make sense to me still. And, you know, I think that just, it shook me, but I think that is just sort of a version of what failures sort of end up looking like professionally and creatively, you know, for the rest of my life, where it is something that you're not going to get a clear answer as to the why. It is going to like to hit you hard, and you either can just wallow in it forever or not. And sometimes I wallow and sometimes I don't. And every time it hurts, and every time you kind of have to pull yourself back up and do something else.
But look what you did to something else with.
Yeah, just 20 years later.
That's so great. Exactly. But, you know, it was during a slump that you thought of the idea.
For sure. No, I mean, it's all the good stuff comes out of a slump. Truthfully, everything, you know, all my favorite things that I've ever done have come out of, like, anger or fear, or I mean, I guess just anger or fear. And you know, it's why great bands stop making good music after a point when they get too happy and comfortable. I mean, it's just, they're not hungry, you know?
Yeah.
And if you feel like it's all going to fall apart at any moment, which I think like it's some part of my brain I perpetually do, then, you know, then you're just gonna stay hungry, stay angry, stay disappointed, stay sad, and then you're gonna be able to like pull out something special.
Hashtag stay sad, everybody.
Oh, hashtag stay sad.
Okay, last question. Do you have a favorite charity?
Sure. Yeah.
What's your favorite charity?
You don't have to. You can also just say one you like.
ACLU? ACLU is good.
All right. $100 going to the ACLU.
Oh, how sweet.
Under your name. Thank you.
Fantastic.
So much. Why not? I mean, we all know what the ACLU is. It's the American Civil Liberties Union.
Hopefully they'll prosecute Trump or some shit.
Yeah, that's all I'm looking to at this point. Yeah. Just
positive like that.
Yeah. Reunite some families.
Yeah. Get kids out of cages.
Kids out of cages.
There will be
basic stuff.
There will be a link in the podcast, of course, that as there always is, for you to donate yourself as well, us to the listeners.
So everybody go watch the movie.
Yes.
August 3rd, right?
Spying on me, August 3rd, yes.
I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. David, thank you so much for being on Family
Thank you, guys.
We loved it. I had a great time.
Thanks.
Thank
bye.
You. Thanks, Eden.